Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Thursday, the 11th of May. In the heaviest fighting in months, Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza exchange airstrikes and rocket fire. 10 people have died in Pakistan during protests over the arrest of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan. The army has warned of a tough response. And
this drone feed over Bakhmut just tells you a scene of utter devastation. Not a single building left. Street to street fighting going on.
We report from Bakhmut as Russia continues its grinding offensive against the small Ukrainian city. Also in the podcast, the Republican Congressman George Santos is charged with money laundering and fraud. And Jewish groups condemn a multi-million dollar sale of jewels linked to the Nazis. A 10-year-old girl is among the latest people killed in the Palestinian territory of Gaza on the second day of fighting between the Israeli military and militants from Islamic Jihad. She's one of at least 21 Palestinians who've died in Israeli airstrikes. Israel said Palestinian militants fired more than 300 rockets into its territory on Wednesday, four of which hit buildings. Speaking ahead of an emergency session of the UN Security Council, the Palestinian representative Riyad Mansour said Israel must be held to account.
We condemn those who committed these crimes, particularly killing a large number of children and women. And we believe that it is the duty of the Security Council to condemn these crimes and to pronounce that those from the Israeli side who have committed these crimes should face accountability.
Earlier, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told his security officials they must be prepared for a long campaign.
My instruction is for us to be prepared, both for the possibility of further expansion of the campaign, as well as for very hard blows now and in the future. All in all, I think that we have the upper hand here, and you are obviously in the midst of this battle, and I appreciate your support and your firm stand.
Earlier, I spoke to our correspondent in southern Israel, Tom Bateman, who was about 30 kilometres from the border with Gaza. He said the attacks there were continuing into the evening.
I'm in Ashdod at the moment. We've been further south of here in the city of Sderot, which effectively sort of borders the Gaza Strip. And while we were there, I mean, we saw Palestinian rockets being fired from Gaza and shot down by Israel's missile defense system. There were repeated sirens during the afternoon. And during that time, there had been multiple Israeli airstrikes, its warplanes bombing the Gaza Strip. And that had followed a series of strikes that began really this morning when we saw the first Palestinian fatalities and then continuing into the afternoon. So this has been a fierce confrontation, although I would say perhaps not with the same level of intensity that we've seen in other bouts of fighting, even though, you know, we've had long-range rocket fire from Gaza reaching Tel Aviv and missile interceptions over Tel Aviv. So that's significant. The level of and the intensity of Israeli airstrikes has been significant as well, and particularly, as you mentioned, after yesterday when we saw Israel targeting those three Islamic Jihad commanders but killing at the same time 10 civilians. So, you know, there has been a lot of concern about this thing escalating, although unconfirmed reports as I speak to you now about a potential ceasefire, but nothing clear at all about that.
Now, there is a clear mismatch in the firepower of each side. Obviously, Israel has a very advanced military, and many of the rockets from the Palestinian territories are shot down before they reach urban areas. But what is it like for both sides living under this exchange of fire?
Well, it's awful. And within the Gaza Strip, when you're under Israeli airstrikes, I mean, it is a terrifying, formidable experience. It's one that Palestinians are depressingly used to by now. It's really a routine way of life, and you sort of find that the quieter periods in between the rounds of fighting just become this sort of inevitable countdown to really when the next outbreak will take place. As you say, they tend to have much higher casualty rates. I mean, there are no shelters or sirens for Palestinian civilians. And for Israelis in both in southern Israel and across the country, when the sirens are ringing out, again, terrifying moments. And the whir of those sirens is something that always stays with you. And of course, rockets do kill people. And we've seen that in recent exchanges in May 2021, for example, 2 years ago today, actually, that round of fighting began.
Tom Bateman in Ashdod in Israel. At least 10 people have been killed in Pakistan in unrest sparked by the detention of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan on Tuesday on corruption charges. The government has now called in the military to help restore order. More than 1,000 people have been arrested. In a televised address to the nation, the Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif said violent protests would not be tolerated.
The role of the law means that you fight for your rights in front of the law and in court. Damaging public infrastructure is absolutely an act of terrorism and enmity with the homeland. I warn these terrorists and the enemies of the country to immediately stop their enmity against the country. Otherwise, the evil ones who underestimate the law will be brought to justice and punished based on the laws.
For its part, the army warned that strong action would be taken against those attacking military installations and public property. Our correspondent in Pakistan, Caroline Davis, witnessed the continuation of the violence on Wednesday.
Imran Khan Zindabad.
We don't need anybody in Pakistan! This is our leader, proud leader Imran Khan!
Anger on the roads of Islamabad. Protesters in Pakistan's capital blocked one of the city's main roads, carrying sticks, stones and slingshots. Many wore swimming goggles or tied scarves around their faces, anticipating tear gas. They did not have long to wait. As the tear gas canisters hit, protesters tried to knock them away with sticks, throwing stones at the police. Similar protests happened in Peshawar, where a hospital reported multiple deaths and casualties. Imran Khan will spend another night in police custody. He appeared in front of judges on two corruption cases. In one, he was formally charged and pled not guilty, meaning the full trial will now begin. On the second, he was told he would remain in police custody for 8 days for investigation. His legal team have challenged his arrest in the Supreme Court. In its first response since the protests began, the Pakistani military said it will not tolerate any further attacks on state institutions. The government has said that the army will help the police quell protests in the capital and Punjab and KP provinces.
Caroline Davis in Pakistan. The battle for Bakhmut has been the longest and bloodiest of the war in Ukraine. Russia has lost thousands of troops, many of them conscripts. Ukraine has too. But despite some Russian advances, the Ukrainians are holding on to some territory at the western edge of the city. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale has this report.
A rare lull in the fighting. And Eugene, a 29-year-old Ukrainian soldier, takes us round a defensive position south of Bakhmut.
You go with him, and we go in next to the forest.
He and the men of 28 Brigade have been helping stop Russia from surrounding the city. The Russian lines are just a few hundred metres away, and as we find out, they're never silent for long.
We'll have to wait a little bit, so we've been now shelled by the mortar. As you can see, that was pretty damn close. Let's go, quickly. So we're going to shoot back right now. Let's get the f*** out of here!
Ukraine's president has called Bakhmut a fortress of Ukrainian morale, the longest, bloodiest battle of the war so far. But despite losing friends, Eugene still expresses that continuing spirit of defiance.
This is the hottest point at this war right now, Bakhmut. We are on the southern outskirts of Bakhmut now. We are not letting the enemy flank troops defending Bakhmut from the south. We've got no other option. This is our country and our land. What else can we do?
Well, you could give up Bakhmut and just move back.
For us, if we would retreat, for example, Yes, we could save a few lives, but then we will have to assault back. We could have lost much more lives. So we need to stand here till the end.
We move closer to the edge of the city.
Go back inside. Okay, let's go.
In a nearby bunker, the men of 77 Brigade direct artillery fire to support their infantry. Ukraine's last line of defense on the western edge of the city.
This drone feed over Bakhmut just tells you a scene of utter devastation. Not a single building left. Street-to-street fighting going on. These guys are supporting with artillery. Ukraine is still holding on to the edges of the city, but only just. Wagner? Are they mostly Wagner fighters?
Yeah.
Staring intently at the screen, Miroslav tells me the Russians don't care about their people. We watch two of their soldiers stumble forward under artillery fire. His friend Mikola adds they show little fear. He says they must be on drugs. The US estimates that more than 20,000 Russians have been killed in the past 5 months alone, many of them here in Bakhmut. But Mikola admits Ukraine's also paying a heavy price.
Many soldiers gave their lives for Ukraine, and now it is hard for us to fight. Now there are quite a lot of military personnel without experience, but a few months will pass and they will become the same warriors as those who fought before them.
Ukraine hopes this battle will have exhausted their enemy, as it now prepares to launch its own offensive. But Bakhmut is a reminder that taking ground can prove far more costly.
Jonathan Beale. And since Jonathan filed his report, a Ukrainian commander has said that Russian units have abandoned some positions in the southwest of Bakhmut and retreated up to 2 kilometres following Ukrainian counterattacks. In recent years, China and Canada have had a number of diplomatic standoffs. In March, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau appointed a special rapporteur to probe allegations that China had meddled in Canada's elections. The latest row has seen tit-for-tat diplomatic expulsions after Canada accused a Chinese diplomat of trying to intimidate a member of the Canadian Parliament over his criticism of China's persecution of Uyghur Muslims. Here's how it's being reported in Canada.
Persona non grata. Canada expels the diplomat at the center of reported interference by China.
Beijing avenges Canada's expulsion of a Chinese diplomat. The tit-for-tat is a direct response to Canada ousting a Chinese diplomat who was accused of trying to intimidate Conservative MP Michael Chong, allegations Beijing has denied.
Well, Michael Chong, the Canadian MP at the heart of the story, has now spoken to the BBC. John Donison asked him about the intimidation he'd said he'd experienced at the hands of the PRC, or People's Republic of China.
The form of the intimidation was that a PRC diplomat accredited by the Canadian government in Toronto was gathering information from his post in Toronto about my family and the PRC in order to potentially target them, to put pressure on me and other MPs in the House of Commons about foreign policy debates and votes that were taking place in the House of Commons.
And this was your family in Hong Kong or your family in Canada?
Gathering information about my family in Hong Kong.
And how did you find out about this?
I found out about this through a report in the Globe and Mail newspaper last week, Monday morning. I'd been contacted by the Globe and Mail before it was published to tell me and ask me my reaction. But that's when I first heard about it. It's not new information that the PRC uses tactics like targeting family of Canadians in the PRC. What was new information last week was that a diplomat accredited by the Canadian government in Canada was part of that operation and that the Canadian government knew and didn't do anything about it.
Right, because what came out in this newspaper report is that the Canadian intelligence services had been aware of this for, what, more than a year?
Yes, for some time, yes.
So you're unhappy about two things, really. You're unhappy, for starters, that your family was being monitored, but also that the Canadian government, of course you're an opposition party member, didn't let you know or do anything about it. So in your view, he should have been kicked out a long time ago.
Absolutely. Any diplomat that uses their position and their immunity to conduct foreign interference threat activities should be immediately removed from the country. And I think that applies to any diplomats engaged in those activities, regardless of country they represent.
Of course, the Chinese government has been extremely critical of this move by Canada and has now responded by expelling one of your diplomats.
That's correct. My view is that we have to stand up for our fundamental principles, and protecting the integrity of our democratic institutions is essential against foreign interference. I think Prime Minister Trudeau has not taken seriously enough the threats to national security. It's clear over many years that our national intelligence service has been ringing the alarm bells about foreign interference threat activities. There's been many public declarations of that threat in front of parliamentary committees, but also in speeches that have been given by the director of the service. And yet it wasn't until news broke that a PRC diplomat was using his post to target an MP and his family that they decided to take action. This action by the Trudeau government should have taken place years ago.
Are you concerned for the safety of your family members, both in Hong Kong and in Canada?
Yes, particularly in Hong Kong. And so that's why I think the government's inaction is puzzling, because this sort of action should have been taken a long time ago to indicate that these kinds of activities are simply not acceptable.
Canadian MP Michael Chong talking to John Donison. When the human genome was first mapped in 2003, most of the data came from a single individual. Now, scientists in the US have produced a new version of the human genome to better reflect the diversity of our planet. It's called the Pan Genome and is made up of data from 47 people from Africa, Asia, the Americas and Europe. Here's our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh.
The human genome was largely completed 20 years ago. It's a map of the basic chemical building blocks that make up our DNA. Researchers use it to identify genes involved in diseases, to develop better treatments. But the downside is that 70% of the original genome came from a single individual of mixed European and African ancestry. This therefore missed critical genetic differences that play a significant role in diseases in people from other backgrounds. The new Pan genome has DNA from a wider range of the world's population. Dr. Eric Green from the US National Human Genome Research Institute in Maryland said in an online news conference that the development has the potential to transform our understanding of how diseases develop.
Having a human pan genome that increasingly reflects the diversity of the human population will enable scientists and healthcare professionals to better understand how genomic variants influence health and disease, and move us towards a future in which genomic medicine benefits everyone.
The scientists have funding to expand the number of people in their pan genome from 47 to 350. After that, scientists leading the largely US program plan to increase numbers and diversity further by working with research organizations from other countries. It's hoped that such an international project will lead to new treatments that work better for a much wider range of people.
Pallab Ghosh. Still to come on the Global News podcast. What is the sound of the year? He was only elected to the US House of Representatives 6 months ago, but George Santos has already become one of the most notorious figures in American politics. The Republican congressman has been caught lying about major portions of his life, including his education, his employment history, and his family's experiences during the 9/11 attacks and the Holocaust. Now, Mr. Santos has been arrested on more than a dozen charges, including fraud and money laundering. He pleaded not guilty in court before speaking to reporters outside.
I'm going to fight my battle. I'm going to deliver. I'm going to fight the witch hunt. I'm going to take care of clearing my name, and I look forward to doing that.
I heard more about George Santos and the charges against him from the BBC's Jessica Parker in Washington.
It's already been a stormy few months for him, but potentially pretty serious for the 34-year-old. He is accused by prosecutors of falsely claiming unemployment benefit during the COVID pandemic, despite largely being receipt of a six-figure salary. He's accused essentially of pocketing thousands of dollars in campaign contributions, but actually spending much of the money on things like designer clothes, personal debts, making withdrawals of cash, and then misleading the House of Representatives in financial declarations. If he were convicted, he could face a lengthy prison sentence. He's previously denied criminal wrongdoing. He said he has a clear conscience.
Yeah, I mean, his integrity was even questioned before he was elected. I mean, claims that he was Jewish and then later saying he didn't mean Jewish, he meant Jew-ish. I mean, he's a very colourful character.
Yeah, there's quite a sort of bizarre trail of allegations that have followed George Santos around. One of them, as you're mentioning there, he's said that his grandparents were Ukrainian refugees. They fled from the Holocaust. He's claimed that he's Jewish. And then, as you said, actually kind of then clarified and sort of said Jew-ish. And there's just other slightly odd things around his background. He's denied claims he ever performed as a drag queen. He's admitted lying on his CV about his academic achievements. He once suggested, or seemed to suggest, his mother had died in the 9/11 attacks, and that evolved into saying she'd been working at the World Trade Center at the time but died some years later, although immigration records, after journalists looked at this, suggested that she wasn't even in the country at that time. So lots of quite strange stories about his background have emerged over the last few months.
Jessica Parker in Washington. Jewish groups have condemned a multi-million dollar sale of jewels linked to the Nazis. The collection was owned by Heidi Horton, wife of a German billionaire who made a fortune operating formerly Jewish-owned businesses during the Nazi era. The collection's being auctioned by Christie's in Geneva. Our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhard has the details.
Heidi Horton adored exquisite designer jewellery.
Lot number 96, the final lot of today's sale. The Sunrise Ruby, sensational Cartier Ruby and Diamond Ring of 25.59 carats. Where should we start this? That's 7 million Swiss francs.
This ring, featuring a pigeon blood-coloured cushion-cut beauty of a Burmese ruby, was billed as the star of the first part of the auction.
Well done, then. Fair warning. Selling, then, to Francois for 11 million francs. Sold for 11 million. Congratulations.
Its final price, $14.6 million with buyer's premium included, was somewhat below estimate. But today's sale alone raised a dazzling $155 million. Other consignments will be auctioned later this week and through to November. But Jewish groups want the sale suspended or stopped. Indecent is how the head of a major French Jewish organisation described it. Mrs. Horton's late husband, Helmut, was a Nazi party member and bought Jewish businesses sold under duress under the Nazi policy of Aryanisation. Christie's say the proceeds will be used for philanthropic causes. The money will be administered by a foundation Mrs. Horton set up in her own name to support medical research, children's welfare, and a museum displaying her art collection. Christie's says it will donate an unspecified portion of its own commission to support research and education on the Holocaust. But the American Jewish Committee criticised this gesture as insufficient. It said before any sale took place, a serious effort was needed to determine what portion of the Hortons' wealth derived from victims of the Nazis. That money, it added, should then be spent on supporting Holocaust survivors and educational programmes.
Danny Eberhard. The UN Human Rights Council will meet in emergency session in Geneva on Thursday to discuss the ongoing conflict in Sudan. Over the past 3.5 weeks of fighting there have been reports of widespread human rights violations, including the indiscriminate bombing of civilians and hospitals. The UN meeting was called by the UK, the US, Germany and Norway, but a number of African countries, including Sudan, are reportedly not keen. From Geneva, here's Imogen Folks.
Sudan faced big humanitarian challenges even before this latest violence. High levels of malnutrition and maternal mortality, refugees from conflicts in Ethiopia and South Sudan. Now hospitals have been attacked and looted, aid agencies cannot work safely, hundreds of civilians have been killed, thousands are displaced. There are reports of sexual violence. It's exactly the kind of situation the UN Human Rights Council should investigate, but African member states appear reluctant. Some are unhappy with country-specific debates, which they view as finger-pointing. Others claim this session could jeopardise tricky talks on a ceasefire. Those who support today's meeting, including the US and the UK, say the United Nations must show the people of Sudan, so many of whom backed their country's transition to democracy, that they have not been forgotten.
Imogen, folks. After battling for years to get the Benin bronzes returned from museums in Europe and the US, Nigeria now finds itself embroiled in a row over where they should end up. Last month, the Nigerian president, Muhammadu Buhari, declared that the Oba, or King of Benin, Uwera II, should become the owner of the Benin bronzes. Uwera II is the great-grandson of the Oba who was toppled by the British. Barnaby Phillips is a former BBC Nigeria correspondent who's written a book called Loot, Britain and the Benin Bronzes. He's been talking to Hassan Aruni.
President Buhari has issued an official declaration acknowledging the Oba of Benin, Uwera II, as the owner of the Benin bronzes, and also giving him sweeping powers over their management during the process of their return from museums in Europe and the United States, saying that he alone must authenticate them, that he will be responsible for their security, working with the federal government. And I think that this is something which will delight the Oba, but the problem is it has also upset Nigeria's National Commission for Museums and Monuments, which is meant to be in charge of national collections of art, and which was not consulted at all, and for whom this declaration came as a surprise.
Why is this a problem that upsets people in the Museums and Monuments Commission, given that the Benin bronzes were taken from the Benin Kingdom in the 19th century, and that's where one would think naturally they belong, or that's where the ownership should lie?
I think at heart, Hassan, this is a debate about how the meaning of objects changes over time. Spiritual objects becoming works of art, if you like. When the Benin bronzes were made, they're made exclusively by a royal guild for the Oba. They were spiritual objects. They weren't on display. Over the decades that they've been in European and North American, and indeed in other Nigerian museums in Lagos and other places, they have become works of art. And that falls under the ambit of the National Commission for Museums and Monuments, which has been busy negotiating their handover with museums and with governments in Germany, in the United Kingdom, in the United States. The National Commission for Museums and Monuments would say that is their responsibility. And if the Benin bronzes belong to the Oba, does that mean that every object in Nigeria belongs to the traditional ruler or community that made it? Perhaps it does, but you can see how that might undermine the rationale for any national collection or museum.
What challenges does this pose to the process of returning artifacts that were taken from Nigeria, specifically the so-called Benin bronzes?
I think we've already seen some practical results. Cambridge's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology here in the United Kingdom, Hassan, it has the second biggest collection of Benin bronzes in Britain, more than 300. It has just postponed a handover ceremony to a Nigerian delegation that would have taken place next week because they're confused. It's a reflection as well of simmering tension between the National Commission of Museums and Monuments and the Oba's Palace. Indeed, the situation is even more complicated than that because there are further tensions between the governor of Benin, Godwin Obaseki, and the palace. And Godwin Obaseki has his own museum project. But I think if you talk to supporters of the Oba, they are keen to stress that this presidential declaration should not be taken too literally. Everyone's stated intention is that the Benin bronzes should be displayed in museums. And everyone's stated intention as well is also, in fact, that some Benin bronzes should remain in institutions in Europe, in the United States, and be ambassadors of the Nigerian culture. So it's a matter of achieving that goal, but overcoming some of the suspicions and jealousies and rivalries which are bubbling under the surface at the moment.
Barnaby Phillips talking to Hassan Aruni. Finally, to some amazing noises. The British Library is hosting an award show on Thursday to recognise innovative and unusual uses of sound captured by ordinary people and professional journalists. The chair of this year's judging panel, Matthew Herbert, talked us through some of the noises on the shortlist, including from inside a glacier and from the war in Ukraine.
This is our third year and started actually really during lockdown when sound became particularly relevant or more important to us. You know, the world got a little bit quieter. One of the very first sounds we got sent was the bells of St. Paul's Cathedral during lockdown, free from traffic and aeroplanes, and actually realise how precious that is. You know, that's a moment that might not be repeated for many years to come. So really it's a chance to listen to the world differently and to capture special moments or things that we think are worth saving or remembering or that can help bring colour to a story in a different kind of way. This is the sound that somebody has recorded, and he's listened to all the different kind of activities that are going on in an Icelandic glacier. So you can hear growls, vibrations of air trapped for hundreds of years being released, but some extraordinary little sort of bubbles and things. You think some of this air hasn't actually been heard or seen or been present for thousands of years. So this recording was made on the third day of the war in Chernihiv. She was going to the shelter at the time, and it's just recorded on her mobile phone. What's extraordinary to me about the sound is there's two layers. You've got something almost daily life, matter of fact, going on in the background, and then these incredibly disturbing and terrifying sounds. And the capacity that sound has to really bring it to life in a way that you don't quite get in the same way with pictures. And I think a sound like this really, really brings home the impact, certainly to me, of the horrors of war. I think this is another extraordinary sound, actually. So this was recorded in Croatia, and it's actually the result of concreting over part of the coastline to make access easier for tourism. It's where man-made bit of concrete meets the natural formations of the rock, and it's always created a hole somewhere where air is being forced through by the sea as it comes in and out. And he was really interested in the anthropomorphic effect of it. But ultimately, sound and music is just the movement of air, really.
Matthew Herbert. That's all from us for now. The Global News podcast, though, will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Chris Kouzaris and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.